Okay, welcome back. If you're not sharing, please mute yourself by clicking the mute icon on your screen or on your phone, star 6, or by pressing microphone on your handset to minimize the noise on our meeting line. Unmute to share by clicking on your computer the same way or star 6 on your phone. As the moderator, I may mute you. Let's say, would somebody care to lead us in the third step prayer found on page 63 of the Big Book? Or if you'd like to, just unmute and we'll go ahead and say that together. Or say that in the space in which you're in. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Big Book Awakening UK teleconference meeting is open to all 12-step programs from anywhere in the world. The Big Book Awakening process supports us to practice the precise directions in the Big Book of AA as a means of deepening our recovery. To keep the meeting focused, we kindly ask that only those who are working the Big Book Awakening process right now and are currently sober from their physical cravings share their experience in the first half of the meeting. All are welcome to listen, and anyone can share or pose a question in the third part of the meeting. Our meeting focus is on the precise directions for working the steps as written in pages up to 103 of the Big Book and using the Big Book Awakening Guide. Well, meeting set up in three parts. We begin by having a speaker share for 20 minutes, then we open it up to those who worked the process before, and then we have a crossfire meeting for anyone to share or ask a question. At that time, okay, that's it. Let's see. Tonight we have Amy, who's going to share with us on more about alcoholism. Amy, you have 20 minutes. Would you like a 5-minute heads up?
Judith, did you hear me?
Now we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, yes, please give me a 5-minute heads up.
Okay, great.
Okay. My name is Amy. I'm a recovered alcoholic and compulsive eater. It's good to be on the meeting this week. I had to miss it last time. So it's part of the circle and triangle that I somehow get to a meeting, even if not necessarily bodily. But tonight we're talking about more about your ism, whether that's alcohol, compulsive eating, Al-Anon. I think there might be some chaos creators floating around out there.
Amy, could you speak up just a little bit louder?
Sure, okay. I might hold the mic a little closer too. So we're looking at, this is the second part of the mental obsession. And, first we look at our physical allergy. What happens to my body when I drink, when I take that first bite, when I restrict, when I overexercise, whatever it is. And I think that can be quite, well, with alcohol, it's quite straightforward. It's a drink or it's not a drink, an alcoholic drink or not an alcoholic drink. With food, it can be more tricky. And I think a huge part of the first step for me with my food was sorting through what were these physical manifestations of my disease. But once I've looked at that, it's this idea that, or if I just didn't ever do that first, whatever it was, first drink, first bite, first action, that I would never have to start, head down that path in the first place. It just seems to be a simple solution. And to people who aren't like us, who aren't the real deal, it's baffling, and they talk about how this disease is baffling and how it affects the people around us. But, the fact is I have that physical allergy, but at the same time, I've got this thing in my mind that says this time will be different. And it was funny because when I first got into AA, I wasn't familiar, BBA wasn't even around then, but you know, nobody ever explained to me about the physical allergy, then followed by the mental obsession and the underlying spiritual malady. But I used to always say at AA meetings when I was newly sober, I would say things like, I could always stop drinking, but I could never not start again. And that quite clearly was my mental obsession. You know, physically, I stopped frequently. I saw, you know, I would have months of dry time. I don't know if I ever actually went a year, but I definitely had months or, you know, occasionally if it was something really important, I could stop or I could, you know, maybe just hold it off long enough to get through whatever I needed to get through. But then I would,
it was just funny. It wasn't even, oh, this is a really bad idea, but I'm going to do it anyway. It was just, it truly is that queer mental twist they talk about. You know, this, like one of the stories in the section, I think, is about the guy that thinks if he puts whiskey in his milk, it'll be okay. It was that hazy for me with the alcohol. And it was all about trying to manage my behavior while drinking. You know, I always think, well, this time I won't drink that sort of alcohol, or this time I'll give my keys to somebody so I won't drive, or this time I won't party with those people. But despite being having a decent amount of intelligence, still that mental twist of thinking, well, the common denominator in, you know, the keys, the not drinking, is the alcohol. You know, just don't put that in your body. But somehow that thought just, and I can still remember clear as day, the day it finally occurred to me that maybe it was the alcohol. You know, looking at the wreckage of my life and going, you know, it could be the alcohol causing it. And why it took 11 years, and I know for some people it takes a lot longer, for it just to even occur to me. And I think that shows the power of our mental obsession. And to me, when I first heard mental obsession, I sort of had this idea that meant I was obsessing about alcohol. But that wasn't my experience. I obsessed about ways to manage my drinking, or ways to drink more effectively, or not get in trouble, or not have the manifestations of trouble that came with drinking. But I was never obsessed about drinking or not drinking. And then it was just like one day, I think it's like God struck me sober, because it was just like a complete revelation that the alcohol could be actually causing all these problems in my life that before I blamed on anything but alcohol. And interestingly enough, with my food, it was completely the opposite. I was quite clearly obsessed about weight, body, food, intake, calories. And I don't know, for me, maybe that's just a fact of that while you can cut alcoholic liquids out of your life, you can never completely cut food out of your life. But, you know, I was quite clear that I had a mental obsession around, you know, that was just crystal clear to me when I got to 12-step programs. Although, again, you know, nobody had ever set it up for me that way. Nobody had ever said, you know, you have this physical allergy that would first, you know, take that compulsive bite or overeat and feel too full, you're going to break out. I mean, it really is, to a normal eater, the idea that when you're so stuffed, you're just going to put more food in there makes no sense. It just, you know, doesn't make any sort of sense. But yet, to, you know, a compulsive eater, I don't even know what my mind says to me, but I just will go against that, what's a normal physiological response. So, the, you know, this mental obsession, and I think with the mental obsession is where I really come up against needing a power outside of myself. Because I think with physical, I kind of think, you know, if I could just get the right combination, or if I just, like I said, if I just drank these drinks or partied with these people or found the perfect diet, or maybe if I did paleo or keto or raw food, you know, whatever, then, so with physical, I was kind of able to think that there might still be some way out there, even though time and time again it happened and over again. But with the mental obsession, I mean, I was quite clear. Like I said, as far as alcohol went, I feel like I was just struck sober. You know, that that was just God saying, you will stop this, because the fact is, the way I drank, I was due to die several times, you know, coming out of blackouts. I would drive in blackouts and, you know, all sorts of really dangerous, reckless things that should have killed me a number of times. So I feel like, you know, God just reached down and took that. And, but with the, you know, the food, oh my God, talk about coming up against powerlessness, not being able to do a darn thing about it for like ever. In fact, you know, when I finally really had a thorough first step experience with my compulsive eating, at the end, I used to pray, you know, God, I don't care if I'm a morbidly obese person, please just make this obsession stop. Please just make me stop, you know, please take away this thinking about it, looking in the mirror, the trying this, trying that, overeating, under, you know, just, I just wanted that gone. And I was so ready to have, you know, this completely removed, and to have it look like whatever God wanted me to look like. But I would say that under the basis of that for me with food was the trust that I think my God, anyway, wants me to be a healthy, productive, and by productive I mean useful to God sort of person. And then I think that if I was morbidly obese, that I wouldn't be. So there is kind of that underlying belief, but it was a complete surrender of, you know, God, you do whatever you need to with me physically. I need relief from this obsession. And I think that that just made for such an effective surrender. And such an opening up for me about, you know, where I needed the help. And just really gives me the drive to walk through this, you know, the fourth step, the making amends, and the continued daily practice. And still, even for me, I think with the food, because again, I didn't struggle a lot with the mental obsession with the alcohol once I realized I had it, you know, that, like I said, it was just lifted out. I'll not say that I haven't had times in my life where I was just like, screw this, I'm going to go have a drink. But I forgot where I was going with that. You know, it's just today, and it's not that like the mental obsession around food has been absolutely removed. But what it is it's kind of like a soft, funny little voice rather than this demanding, overpowering thing I couldn't do. You know, like last night, I had a bigger meal than I would have liked to at dinner, and I was fuller than I like to be. And it was just like, instead of listening to that voice that said, oh, just keep eating, you're never going to get that dessert again, you've got to eat it all because you won't have it again, I was just like, you know, I wonder if they do takeout boxes in the UK. I'm just going to ask. And sure enough, they do. And away we went. And it was just, it is gone, but in a slightly different way. And again, it was nothing I could do. It was, you know, I was beyond human aid, as they say. And, you know, they taught the first page of the More About Alcoholism, it's like that unwilling to admit, not willing to think that I'm bodily and mentally different. And then we've been characterized like countless vain attempts to prove I could drink or eat like other people. And for me, too, that is a little bit more of the physical, because it was an action. I was trying to switch up how I drank or when I drank or how I ate. But just, I suppose in that way, you know, it was an obsession for alcohol, but it was, you know, quite clearly an obsession with the food. And to not live in that today is one of the greatest gifts I've ever gotten in the 12 steps. You know, whatever else happens, however my relationships improve or my finances improve or my job improves. And I have to say, all of those things have happened. They have occurred for me. Not the way I thought they would, and, you know, not because I made them happen, but just because they're side effects of the fact that this, you know, the primary fact of my life used to be this mental obsession, and that was what occupied my days, my nights, any my waking moments. And then and that's not true today. In fact, I just go around, and again, it's just so different because what I used to want, I guess you'd say, was to be happy. But what happy meant to me was not feeling anything, not being uncomfortable, like sort of just being numb, basically being drugged, you know, being like I was after the first, you know, I could usually do one or two drinks and I'd have this lovely, lovely feeling. And then, of course, I'd dive off the deep end. But that feeling, or that feeling when I take the first bite of whatever that thing, and there's just kind of this relief. So I think I was looking for my life to look like that. And instead, oh, it just looks, the best word that comes to mind is peaceful, because I finally have some relief from, you know, this mind, this mental illness, essentially. And, you know, I love in the 10th step where it says we'll straighten out mentally and physically. And when I was going through this work the last time, I just read that every day and hung on to that. You know, God promises that I will straighten out mentally and physically. And I had no idea what that was going to look like. And I had no power, choice, or control to make it look like anything. You know, I couldn't, I had no ability within me to follow any particular food plan or any sort of eating or any sort of exercise. And so I just kept believing that 10-step promise. And in the end, it's like I said, my life is so peaceful. And I have these moments of, they're not quite happiness, because happiness is like sort of too fleeting and too fluffy. They're more just like a deep contentment with, in a moment, you know, just as I'm driving home from somewhere, and I just feel like, oh, everything's all right. Everything's okay right now. And then all these other things have happened in my life to do with career and relationships and parenting and job that I could have never envisioned. But they're just sort of side effects. They're not what are making me happy. What is making me deeply contented and peaceful is, you know, not living with the mental obsession, you know, not living in the spiritual malady that drives the mental obsession. Judith, can I just check you guys? I'm still on the call.
Yep, absolutely. You've got 5 more minutes.
Okay, thank you. Occasionally, I'm calling in by phone, and occasionally it just drops the call, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've probably been rattling on for 10 minutes to nobody, but yes, glad to hear I'm still on the call. So, yeah, I think that it is just such a marvel to me still to have my disease laid out so clearly the way we look at it in the BBA and the way it was laid out in the big book. You know, we take it straight from the big book. And just this, you've got the physical allergy, then you've got the mental obsession, then you've got the spiritual malady. And the way the book starts with the one that's the most immediate, because most of us get here in some sort of disaster from our physical allergy. And then to look at what lies underneath it, and then, you know, even further beneath that. And if I don't see how horrible and awful it is, you know, that's what gives me the drive to do this work. And one of my favorite speakers says that, it has to do with, I may not have any power, choice, and control over my drug, my alcohol, my food, but I do have power, choice, and control over picking up this book, doing my transcribing, taking other people through the work, you know, being on this meeting. Those are all things that I can do and that I have the power to do if I haven't quite gotten enough power from God to do other things, you know, to deal with my food or my alcohol. So I think that, you know, when I'm taking people through the work, I think sometimes in the early stages, all we can do is just pray pray for God's care and protection and, you know, get out of the way of that god-awful speeding train that is the combination of physical allergy and mental obsession that we have no power over. But, you know, we do have the power. I have the power to do the work, to reach out and ask somebody to take me through, to take somebody else through, to, you know, those are all things within my arena of power on arriving in BBA or, you know, at the 12-step program. And those things are enough. Thank God they're enough because, you know, I didn't have any power to change my addiction. I probably still don't to this day. But, again, you know, just lately the peace and deep level of contentment is really amazing to me, and it's not something I ever could have imagined having as a result. I think, I don't know what I thought life would look like living free, but it was definitely probably a lot more exciting or more, I don't know, bigger somehow. Instead, it's just quiet and comfortable, and, you know, I can't say enough about how BBA has changed my life after nearly 30 years in the programs. And, you know, if anybody out there is dry, if you're the one thinking that for some reason AA doesn't work for you or OA doesn't work for you, it's not that it doesn't work for you. It's that there's, some of us are just a certain type. We're the real deal. And the only thing that works for us is a spiritual solution. So I think I'll end there, Judith, if that's okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much. Thanks, Amy. Okay, let's see. It is now time for sharing, general sharing. We have two sections to our sharing. Anyone who has worked the Big Book Awakening process up to this step, which is step one, part two, the mental obsession, can share at this time. Please stay on topic. We're reading more about alcoholism, page 30 and to 37. We have, let's see, 3-minute shares. Please time yourself. I'll also, actually, no, I can't use the timer while I have the recording on, I don't think. Oh, we're going to take the recording off because we have decided not to record anybody's shares, only the speaker. So I'll stop that now.